Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In just the last three decades, we've lost half of the world's coral reefs. There are a number of different factors at play, but it's clear that the warming of the world's oceans is a huge contributing factor. The goal of the documentary Chasing Coral was to capture the response and death of a coral reef on film in real time, in an effort to show the world what's happening beneath the waves. Here's a moment from the film.
We look at climate change as if it's an issue in the air. And you go 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, does that really matter? But when you talk about the ocean, it's like your body temperature changing. And imagine your body temperature rises 1 degree centigrade or 2 degrees centigrade. Over a period of time, that would be fatal. And that's the seriousness of the issue when you look at it in terms of the ocean.
The documentary is on Netflix, and Zachary Rego, one of the people instrumental in getting the film made, is here with me now. Hello, Zach.
How are you? I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Wow, thank you so much for being here. And this film was inspired by another film, actually one that we featured on Talk of Iowa a couple of years ago, called Chasing Ice. And the focus of that film was to show the world images of polar ice and glacial ice melting because of global warming. Now, coral reefs are being affected in a very different way, but what exactly? Tell me about the phenomenon that you set out to capture on film.
Yeah, so much like melting glaciers, coral bleaching, this phenomenon that happens when sea surface temperatures are getting too hot for this ecosystem, they turn white. So the corals lose their pigmentation, and it's a very visual thing. And so much of this planet lives life in the slow lane, much like the glaciers and just like the corals, that this time-lapse technology, which is at the core of both films, is a way for us to communicate these issues that are happening around the planet in a much powerful way. It's a huge perspective shift for people to be able to, you know, gather these month-long or multi-year-long events and see it in a very short, digestible period of time. So corals around the world have seen an enormous shift in their temperatures over particularly the past 5 years. And that was the event that we kind of set out as a giant adventure and a giant idea that we had to, you know, let's share this with the world and do so in a powerful way. And we spent 3.5 years just running around the planet, trying really hard to capture this very evasive thing, and we eventually were pretty successful.
So, all right, before we even talk about what coral bleaching is, this phenomenon that you worked so hard to capture and did in such a beautiful way, when you're introduced in the film, you call yourself a coral nerd. So I can't think of anybody better to help us really understand what a coral reef is and why we should care about them. So first, I mean, it's such an unusual ecosystem. What is a coral reef?
Yeah, so I think first and foremost, a coral reef is this phenomenally beautiful place. Aesthetically, there's really no other ecosystem on the planet that resembles it, just the colorful nature of it. And it's just so vivid and so structurally intricate. There's so much going on and so much life thriving there that I think that's what originally pulls you in as a human. But more so than that, it plays a pivotal role in the marine ecosystem, but also in the global ecosystem. So when we think of coral reefs, they actually provide habitat or life for 25% of all living things in our oceans. That's a huge number when you consider that coral reefs only cover about 0.1% of the actual ocean floor. So talking about a quarter of marine life falling into these little tiny patches around our planet. And
so kind of like the cities of the ocean.
Totally. They are literally the cities of the ocean where everything kind of, where all of that bustling activity and productivity happen. So they're instrumental into the health of the global ocean community.
And of course, humans, speaking of cities, when we build things for people to live in, we build all these structures. Coral, they build structures too. Coral is a keystone species. They create their environment, but they are building themselves. So tell me how a coral lives and how that reef is created.
Yeah, so what makes a coral so interesting, and I think this is kind of at the core of what got me so infatuated in them, is they are both a animal, they're kind of a plant as well, and they're also kind of a rock. So it's an animal that incorporates an algae inside of their tissue. That algae actually produces the energy needs for the coral to grow. And when they grow, they're producing a calcium carbonate or chalk or limestone skeleton. So it's all of these moving factors in which the name of the game on a coral reef is to grow as much outwards and upwards as you can. And it's a giant competition for space. Which they're remarkably good at. They've been doing it for hundreds of millions of years. And it's that structure that they're building that's ultimately what we call a reef. So the reef itself isn't actually the corals or the fish or any of these things. It's the structural component that's there. It's this living thing that continues to build upwards and outwards. And it does things from protecting our shores, from massive waves, from turbidity. They're better than the wave breaks that we can make, right? Because they're constantly building them. They don't have to go out and do repairs because it's a perpetual process. So they are these really interesting organisms because they have these like three amazing factors that seem so drastically different from each other. And I think that's what makes them so interesting and what, as you said, makes them that keystone species because they are the foundation of that entire ecosystem.
Well, when we meet you in the film, we get to see your coral tanks that you have at home. I mean, this was just a hobby of yours, growing coral at home. And you said something in the film that I found really interesting, which is if you can create and sustain the right conditions, coral will grow indefinitely. So it only is going to die if you mess it up, which is really poignant because you can create that environment in your apartment or in your home. But the oceans right now are shifting so dramatically that coral is having a really hard time surviving.
Yeah, I mean, when we were working on the project, I jokingly would say, you know, I've got more healthy coral reefs at my own house than I do where we are right now in Australia, which is a very odd thing to say and a pretty daunting thing to say from my perspective. But you're definitely right. They don't necessarily have a life expectancy because they're basically clones. So they grow asexually as well as sexually, and they just kind of butt off. And so what's cool even in the aquarium world is like you can take a coral colony and you could cut it up into 1,000 little pieces, and now you just have 1,000 baby corals. They're going to go on and continue living. And so if you look at it that way, they are perpetual. They will just continue going on as long as that environment does support the needs that they so desperately have, because they live in a very particular environment and their parameters are extremely sensitive to change. And that's where the core of why they're in such a precarious situation comes from, is those parameters need to be perfect. And as soon as you change one of them, even in the slightest way, like 2 degrees centigrade, which is where this bleaching phenomenon comes from, you can see a catastrophic consequence all the way down that ecosystem.
The bleaching phenomenon that you set out to capture in this film, what is happening when coral loses its color? How is it? Why is it responding that way?
Yeah, so we just talked a little bit about how these corals have an algae that lives inside of them. So they're kind of an animal. They're kind of a plant. And this plant that has incorporated itself into the tissue, that's the instrument that allows them to continue living. Without that energy, they can't build that skeleton and they can't continue living. Well, when that plant gets too warm, it starts to produce really nasty molecules. You could think of it as the same type of molecules that happen when you smoke a cigarette. It's the oxidants, basically, that tear up the inside of the coral. And much like we do when we get sick or we have something inside of our body that is not supposed to be there, we try and get rid of it. So these corals will actively remove that algae from their tissue and leave behind their transparent flesh, and you can see the stark white skeleton underneath. And so we deemed that with the word bleaching because of that white coloration, but it's ultimately the loss of their number one energy source. And it's because they can't cope with the heat.
Okay, so they think, well, they don't think, but they're protecting themselves.
You could argue that they think they're actively making a decision to get rid of something.
So it's an act, it's a response to protect.
Yeah, it's a stress response. It's actually an amazing evolutionary feat. If they didn't bleach, they would die because they would be chewed up from the inside out from these algae kind of freaking out, so to speak. So without bleaching, the coral's dead anyways. It's a survival mechanism.
But it's an unsuccessful survival mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely.
It only extends life by
a month, give or take.
All right. And so there doesn't seem to be any way to come back from that.
Yeah, unless the temperature goes down. Once you hit that month time period on average, then that coral's in a position where it's essentially starving to death, and you start to begin that process of mortality.
And I know I've read many articles over the years about coral bleaching, and people who spend a lot of time looking at coral reefs, photographing coral reefs, studying coral reefs had, you know, gone to a place, gone away, came back, and here the reef is bleached and or already dead.
Yep.
So you set out to capture that transformation, which is so much harder than it sounds. How do you know where to go?
You don't. As you'll see in the film, we tried a lot of different kind of ideas to capture this. And a lot of that was based in historical data. So I failed 3 times in the Northern Hemisphere. And that was my fault because our cameras just didn't function the way that they were supposed to.
So you were in the right place at the right time, but the cameras didn't
Exactly. And then I was in the wrong place at the right time at in Australia, and that was because historically the Southern Great Barrier Reef bleaches pretty extensively. We saw that in 1998, and we saw it again in 2002. So as anyone would do, I look at that data and I say, okay, well, let's go to the Southern Great Barrier Reef and try and capture this if we get a large bleaching event here in 2016. Obviously, we end up there, and it ends up bleaching in the north.
Well, and we'll get to what happened in the north in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking to Zachary Rago. He's one of the people who was instrumental in making the film Chasing Coral. It's a documentary that shows the world what's going on in the world's coral reefs as we are losing many of them very rapidly. In 30 years, we've lost 50% of the world's coral reefs. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Chasing Coral is on Netflix. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Zachary Rago. He's one of the filmmakers responsible for the new documentary Chasing Coral, which is on Netflix right now. And the documentary shows what happens as a coral reef dies in response to the warming of water temperatures around it, the bleaching of a coral reef. And Zachary, we were just talking before the break about how you set out to capture this on film. It had never really been captured on film before. So you had to be a bit of a fortune teller and say, okay, we see that the water around this reef is getting warmer. And we think that right now in the next 2 months or whatever time period is the time that the bleaching is going to occur. You invented a kind of camera to plant there, a time-lapse camera that could remain clear and open and clean so that you could capture that over time. And you didn't quite get it done. So then you went to Australia, to the Great Barrier Reef. And that's another really poignant moment in the film because you have dreamed of going to the Great Barrier Reef your whole life. Tell me more about that, about how that became such a passion for you.
I got involved in the ocean space really young. My father, who's a school teacher in Colorado, runs a program. He takes 40 students to the Big Island of Hawaii every year. So I grew up getting to shadow high school kids and go on that kind of marine biology oriented trip and spend some time underwater. And I just fell in love with it. And I've had a lot of amazing opportunities. I've been very lucky in my life to, you know, have the opportunity to continue pursuing what I do love. And that is the coral reefs have been my great escape. And obviously, I think anyone that's a diver or into coral or into the ocean period, the Great Barrier Reef's the crown jewel. It's the one of the world's seven natural wonders. It's an incredible place. But for me, it was not necessarily how I had planned it to go. You know, I had the opportunity to go to the Great Barrier Reef essentially to watch it die. That was my job, was to go document it. And that's something that I definitely had to manage, because that's not an easy thing to embark on. But it was also something that was extremely important to me, because there's just the thought in the back of your head that you're part of something way bigger than yourself. And surely there's some selfish frustrations in that, that you're watching something that you really love kind of wither away in front of you. But to be able to have an opportunity to share that story that is so out of sight and out of mind, you know, with the average person, that's a really special thing.
Now, there are very few people who haven't heard of the Great Barrier Reef, but I think a lot of us fail to really fully understand its enormity. So give me an idea. How big is the Great Barrier Reef?
Yeah, so the Great Barrier Reef, distance-wise, you could consider it the length of the east coast of the United States. It's made up of a few thousand individual reefs throughout that area. And it's about the size of Italy, or about the size of half of California.
Okay, so
It's enormous. Yeah. I've been lucky enough to spend a lot of time on the Great Barrier Reef, and I haven't scratched the surface.
So you set off to go to the Great Barrier Reef, and as you were saying just before the break, you decided to go to the south part of the Great Barrier Reef. You were predicting a bleaching event. You get there, and what happens?
Yeah, so there's a kind of complicated as well, because I was in the south, and we were about 7 days away from a mass bleaching event in the south while I was there. And then Hurricane Winston, which ultimately hit Fiji as a Category 5 hurricane, or cyclone, as they would say in the southern hemisphere, that ultimately cooled off the southern Great Barrier Reef. It brought a few weeks of rain and cloud coverage that basically saved the south.
Pulled it back from the brink.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of that warmer water was pushed up into the north, and the northern Great Barrier Reef ultimately was kind of the epicenter of what would become the largest bleaching event in history. And so we had to pick up everything that we had, including the cameras that we spent so much time developing, and leave them behind and go up into the north. And we ultimately had to do these time lapses by hand.
So you had invented these cameras just to capture this phenomenon that you could plant under the ocean surface that could take this time-lapse photography, but you didn't have time to pull them back up from where you had planted them and move them somewhere else?
Yeah, so logistically it was an issue, A, because the bleaching was already taking hold. So we were on this giant timer saying, you know, you have to go now in order to get this done. But it was also very logistically challenging, because most of the permitting and all of these complex logistical things that go into a project like this just weren't working out for us. We had spent so much time and energy and resources to get them into the south that we didn't have the time left with the positioning that we were in with the bleaching event to move all of our equipment up into the north, especially because they were in a lot of different places.
So you had to do this manually. How did you do that manually? What was your role in that? And of course, it wasn't just you, but how did you actually capture those images?
Yeah, it was, we were never supposed to go that route. There are conversations that are on film about us saying, well, it's totally crazy for us to think about doing this manually and camping out on an island and diving every day and taking these manually. And ultimately, that's what we ended up doing. So it was every day basically went like this. It was 9 a.m., have a quick breakfast, get in the water, dive for about 2.5 hours. We had about 60 sites, about 30 each. So I would have the reef mapped out, and I would go down with my tripod and my camera, and I would go through site by site by site. come back, fill
you
up
take
your,
the same
the
images
same photos
every day
over and over again at the same 25 sites every day for about 2 months. And then you come back, eat lunch, go dive another 2.5 hours,
wow,
come back, dinner, sleep, do it all again the next day. But you're spending 5 to 6 hours a day underwater and doing the exact same photographs. So you get to know the sites really well, and you no one's really observed a coral bleaching event in that sense. You know, we have lots of images that are of a reef beforehand and afterwards, but to watch that middle ground, to see the processes going on, that's something that had never really been done before. So it's extremely taxing, both physically and then obviously emotionally. You're taking away, we designed something that went underwater that needed no help from us and was supposed to just do this job. And when we had to do it manually, you add in this, the human aspect where you are, you know, you're witnessing it as well. And that is emotionally taxing for sure.
Yeah. What was that like for you? Because you are watching the reef die before your very eyes. Now, nobody had ever seen this before.
Yeah. It's tough for sure. It's, you know, coming from me, I really do love coral reefs. I hope that shows in the film, but, there's part of me that I look back on it and you almost don't necessarily realize what you were doing because it was such a labor of love, the project, that I was just so committed to getting these images and committed to telling this story that, it was, not necessarily something I thought about every day, but there are specific moments where, you know, something triggers you to really look back on what you've witnessed, whether that be the first time that I really went back and looked at image one and then went diving, and you get this more overarching view on what you've seen and what's actually happening here and the scale at which it's happening. But it's not easy. There are definitely days where I just feel super down in the dumps while we're doing it and just don't really want to be there anymore because it's something that I care so deeply for. And it was just disgusting to watch it happen. And one of the things that we don't talk about in the film that puts it into a little bit of perspective as to how much death we were seeing is most days you get out of the boat and you stink like rotting flesh because these are animals. They're falling apart. It's necrotic tissue. And you're swimming around in it for hours in a day and you get out and it smells like you've been rolling around in like nasty rotting meat, essentially. And so it puts it into perspective of just how drastic these events were. Because we're not talking about one little coral colony here bleaching and dying. That's one thing. But we're talking about an ecosystem-wide just devastation and collapse of that ecosystem.
You also saw something that no one had ever seen before in this event. Not just bleaching, but as the reef was getting stressed, it started fluorescing and actually becoming these incredibly brilliant, incredibly beautiful colors. And this wasn't a phenomenon that anybody had witnessed at all before, right?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Like, we know that it's happening, but to see at scale, like in New Caledonia, with the footage that you see with just fields of this bright purpley blue, vibrant color. At scale, that's something that we hadn't necessarily seen. It does happen, but it's so understudied. You could imagine, you know, you have an opportunity maybe every decade to study that phenomenon, and we're talking about a week or two period to do so. So it's really challenging from the scientific perspective to really be able to look at that that phenomenon. But it is something that was really challenging for me because it is so beautiful. I can't think of anything else in nature that is as aesthetically stunning as that. The colors you can't put into words. The camera can't fully capture that beauty.
And do we know why it happens?
So there's a few guesses. Yeah, I get this question a lot, especially with kids, and I jokingly say, well, if you answer that question, you'll have a PhD real quick. but there's a couple thoughts there, and the first one is that they're protecting themselves from the sun. So corals can actually bleach from too much light radiation as well, so excess UV, much like we put sunscreen on to protect our skin so we don't get cancer. The corals are basically doing the same thing. They're taking that reserve energy tank that they have, and they're saying, I'm going to produce something that's at least going to you know, give me a little bit of a better chance. It's just another survival mechanism added on to the bleaching. But we don't know that for certain. That's our best guess. And I think that that's probably the most likely answer. The other one, which I think is extremely interesting, would be like similar to how flowers have UV signs on them. So a butterfly sees a flower much differently than we do. The flowers actually have UV patterns on them that are basically a welcoming sense. Come pollinate me, come pollinate me. And there's a thought that these corals fluoresce and the fish and the microorganisms that live in the water column are actually seeing that and being attracted to it. And therefore, the corals are actually having more access to food. So they're providing themselves a little bit extra energy during this time period where they've lost their main energy source. There's some really fascinating thoughts behind that. But quite frankly, we don't have a consensus or a full thought out idea there.
So you successfully captured this phenomenon, this bleaching phenomenon, in a way that nobody had ever been able to capture it on film before. In 2016, you were definitely in the right place at the right time. And there was an unprecedented bleaching event. How much of the Great Barrier Reef was lost in 2016?
In 2016, the far northern section of the Great Barrier Reef lost about 67% of their corals. So in an overall system, that's about 29% of the corals on the Great Barrier Reef died in 2016. That's obviously paired up with one of the largest El Nino events we've ever seen. What was more surprising, and that's not in the film, is 2017, it actually bleached again, mostly in the central region. So in the past 2 years, we've actually lost about 50% of the corals on the Great Barrier Reef in just a two-year time period. So that back-to-back consecutive bleaching is something that we've never seen before, at least on the Great Barrier Reef. And in both scenarios, it was pretty devastating.
Are you expecting that the entire Great Barrier Reef will die?
No, not necessarily. So I just got back from Australia a couple months ago and was one of the first teams to go into that far northern section that was hit so hard. And while I can't sit here and tell you that everything's all fun and dandy up there, there's certainly a great deal of extreme degradation. But there are still pockets of extremely hopeful places. And in fact, some of them shouldn't be there. Some of them are so magnificent in places where everything else around them has been damaged beyond repair. So right now it's about figuring out what those ecosystems have to tell us and why are they that way. And the South in particular is still remarkably beautiful. So there's plenty to fight for on the Great Barrier Reef. I know 50% sounds like this incredibly large number, and it is. But there's still so much beauty and so much magic on the Great Barrier Reef and on reefs worldwide that we have so much to fight for. And there's so much interesting science going on because of these events that do give me a great deal of hope. But corals are in a lot of trouble, no questions asked. We're going to lose a significant amount of coral moving forward. And by the mid-century point, that number could be upwards of 90%. But that 10% is worth fighting for, and there's they have the secrets. They're alive for a reason, and we need to figure out why and how we can help push that type of characteristic forward for not only the future of ourselves, but for this beautiful ecosystem.
So as I mentioned earlier, I mean, this is something that's happening underneath the surface of the ocean. It's something most of us don't see, don't think about. Your images really show us what the problem is. And there's a, toward the end of the film, when you're showing this footage for the first time, you've got an entire auditorium full of scientists, most of them wiping away tears because it's just so shocking and so devastating. It's pretty depressing. And there's certainly a feeling of hopelessness that can come over you watching these images. What do you want people to take away from the film? You don't want us to feel hopeless, I don't think.
No, I don't want you to feel hopeless. I think there's a lot of space to feel great optimism right now. And I think if you put corals and back them into a corner and focus on just that, it can be really difficult to find a lot of optimism. But when you take the global perspective and take the human perspective, I think there's space for a lot of hope. And particularly even in the past few years, there's so much pessimism around the environment right now. But if you really look at what's happened, for instance, pulling out of the Paris Agreement, that has a chain reaction down the other end of the stick. We've seen more individuals and big businesses and state governments, local governments, begin to take a stand, say, I'm going to hold my own here and actually be a participant rather than a superior in the grand scheme of things and try and do better. And I think that's where the hope has to lie is nothing's ever come easy. There are going to be mountains and there's going to be valleys, and we have to continue pushing through that fight. And I think that we're positioned right now in a very unique way to really cause a big splash. And I do think that that starts with the next generation. It starts with our youth right now. It starts here at the University of Iowa. These are the people that are going to be making a change in the next 5 years, in the next coming decades. And I have great hope because I can see that change in those generations' eyes. And I can see their passions for the natural world and all of the other issues that we're facing. And we're having conversations about it. We're no longer talking doom and gloom about environmental issues. We're no longer trying to scare people and tell them how to live their lives. We simply need to start a conversation. We need to open that door and make it cool again and make it worth fighting for and make it worth it socially and economically. And I think we're on the forefront of that, where there's some amazing people doing incredible work to push those things forward, despite what many of us think.
Zachary Rago, thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys. I really appreciate you having me.
Zachary Rago, one of the filmmakers behind the documentary Chasing Coral. He was in Iowa City this week speaking with students, showing the film. The film is available to anybody who has Netflix. Again, it's Chasing Coral. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.